I added one more podcast to the giant podcast bin. Now you have plucked that podcast out and started listening.
I took my microphone and found some human folk. Then I recorded all the noises while we spoke. My name is Adam Buxton, I'm a man. I want you to enjoy this, that's the plan.
Hey, how you doing? Adam Buxton here. Thank you very much indeed for joining me once again for the Adam Buxton podcast, episode number 19 this is. And it is the beginning of May 2016. And it's actually a very, very pretty evening out here in East Anglia. After a few weeks of fairly grim, cold windowsiness, it is, it's lovely. The bluebells are coming out. The cherry blossom is popping from the trees like cherry blossom. And the problems of the world seem a long way away, especially for Rosie. Her biggest concern is whether she can find some deer to terrorise. This is her favourite route through the wood because there tend to be quite a few monkjack deer that appear from the undergrowth every now and again. She goes yipping and yapping after them very excitedly. One day, she will be cornered by one of those monkjack deer and get absolutely duffed in. It does happen sometimes to unlucky dogs. Any luck, Rosie?
No, I haven't found anything.
That's a pretty spectacular view, isn't it, Rosie? Look at that. We've just come to the edge of the woods and we're looking out over a wide expanse of field. And it's very green and lush. The sun is going down and half the field is now bathed in a yellow light. The other half is in shade. I've got a real gift for describing nature, don't I, Rosie? What do you think?
Yes, you do.
Thanks. Anyway, so listen, this week's podcast features a conversation between myself and Ben Bailey-Smith, better known by his stage name, Doc Brown. He's an English rapper, comedian, actor, screenwriter, and voiceover artist. He played D.S. Joe Hawkins in the TV series Law & Order UK. It's just one of the many things that I failed to talk to Ben about. I mean, these are not comprehensive career-spanning interviews that I do here on this podcast. I think you've probably realised that by now. Occasionally we'll dip in and out of career things, but sometimes it's fun just to chat, just to be two humans having a chat. Why is my voice gone like that? I don't know. Just bringing it down. There we go. We talked about how Ben got into comedy. We discussed the sad story of Amy Winehouse, who Ben knew a little bit, worked with her as part of Mark Ronson's travelling musical bandwagon back in the day. We talk about the deceptively difficult art of writing books for young children. That's something that Ben has done recently. We talk about that and other classics of the genre. There is rather too long a section, for my taste, in which Joe Cornish's film, Attack the Block, is fulsomely praised by Ben, who I forgot was actually involved with the production.
More than I was, probably.
We also talk about offensiveness in comedy. But we began our ramble chat by discussing an area of artistic endeavour in which I am, I think, generally considered to be something of an authority. And that is, of course, rapping and rappers. Which is good because it gives me an excuse to dig out an old jingle, my Rapping Man jingle, from the old Adam and Edith days. And stick that in as well. So, without further ado, here we go.
Ramble chat, let's have a ramble chat. We'll focus first on this, then concentrate on that. Come on, let's chew the fat and have a ramble chat. Put on your conversation coat and find your talking hat.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
La 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 la
there about old Dirty Bastard?
I was just saying a friend of mine interviewed him once and came back from the States only to find the audio mangled. Went to organise another trip out there off his own back because the magazine wouldn't pay for his mistake. And unfortunately, ODB died before he got on the flight.
Oh, no. Yeah.
A huge loss to hip-hop, and I'm going to go out there and say comedy.
Yeah.
Because I listened to Return to the 36 Chambers. That album has got a whole other layer to it that's almost like a kind of piece of Red Fox or like that classic kind of nightclub 70s black underground comedy. And well, it really is there. It's there.
That's good advice for me too then, because I never cracked that album when it came out. And I tried, but I never even got on with The Chronic and, you know, all that.
Too aggressive?
Yes, it was. I was just too used to pop music.
Yeah.
You know, I grew up listening to Thomas Dolby and the Thompson Twins and then Bowie, and it was a certain
sure.
kind of, and I just didn't have the open-mindedness at that point to accommodate something so different.
I think I was relatively similar. You know, I was listening mainly to indie, but I did listen to bits of hip-hop, but the kind that you'd expect an indie fan to listen to. So yeah. I listened to like De La, all the Native Tongue stuff,
right,
Black
exactly.
Sheep, Tribal Quest,
yes, exactly.
The Far Side. Probably the hardest I went at that stage of my life was the Beatnuts, you know?
Yeah.
And it was a neighbour of mine, Mike, in 93, who played me, he made me a little tape of Return to the 36 Chambers, the first Wu-Tang album. And I put it on and turned it off within about a minute and a half. To me, it sounded like mangled, screaming, like heavy metal played backwards. I couldn't compute. I had no reference point for it at all. So it took me a long time.
And what
was
the part, how did you break through then?
So it was 93, so it was about 15. So I think we were just starting to creep into certain raves, you know, ones where they, you know, back in the 90s where they wouldn't care how old you were. And these tended to be mainly like alternative raves that play a bit of everything because mm-hmm. we were still too scared to go to actual rap clubs. I think it was there when I started hearing Protect Your Neck and Wu-Tang Clan Ain't Nothing to Fuck With on big speakers, you know, and seeing guys like moshing out, and that I think that was the turning point. Then I went back and listened to again. I thought, actually, no, this is accessible.
Yeah, I remember being derided that I used to work at a restaurant called Smolensky's in the Strand.
I know it. Yeah,
I was a bartender for a long while, and there was a busboy there called Ricky. He's a little rat boy.
Rat boy. Rat boy Ricky.
And he used to take the piss out of me and the stuff I would listen to. What are you fucking listening to? Listen to your fucking De La Soul, your fucking hippie hop.
Hippie hop, yeah.
He used to call it, do you like your little flower power hippie hop? he thought it was ludicrous, inauthentic.
Yeah.
For me, it was a great entry point, man, because
definitely.
They were sampling all this unusual
definitely.
Stuff and mm-hmm. sampling artists that I knew about. And so it was non-threatening is what it was. But then from there, you know, I was able to make a transition to Eric B. and Rakim and things like that.
There you go.
Understand the value in that and get something out of
there
it.
There you go. There's always been a weird split within hip-hop culture between sort of what's considered like street stuff and sort of crossover mm-hmm. stuff, you know. And with every era of hip-hop, it's always been there, but just been called slightly different things. So like later in the 90s, it sort of became like the difference between like gangster rap and or street rap and backpack rap is what they'd call it. The stuff that like maybe skaters would listen to or students.
Uh-huh.
To me, it's all rap. Like if it's good, then I'll listen. If it's got some substance to it, I don't really mind like what other people describe it as. For me, there's a huge difference between certain street rappers. Some have no substance, some have it all. Like, you know, a lot of people like Rick Ross at the moment, but to me he's not saying anything other than what you hear on the surface. So, you know, I think you just treat it like you treat all musical forms. How much depth does it have? Will you still be listening to it in 20 years time?
I mean, I'm drawn to, in whatever genre, I'm drawn to characters, you know, talking
big
about
time.
RZA and people like that, and you know, in Public Enemy, of course, it's Flavor Flav, the clown.
Slick Rick.
Kendrick Lamar seems like a character now.
Big time.
I can't say I know a huge amount about him, but I bought that album last year and thought it was pretty interesting.
Very complex individual, kind of in his own genre, that standalone. There's just no other rappers like him. And the best guys are always like that, I think. In every genre of music, the best guys seem to be within their own subgenre.
Hello, I'm a rapping man. I quit my job to rap. People say I shouldn't have done that because my rap is crap. But I keep on rapping because that's what I do. Never listen to advice. That's my advice to you. Rapping.
Yes.
So you started rapping. And getting paid for it at a pretty early age, is that right?
Yeah, I guess, but never enough to make a real career out of it. You know, I was one of those kids who always wrote rhymes, but, you know, I kept them to myself. I was just, you know, I never felt I had the requisite kind of backstory to be a rapper, you know, because the kids that I saw becoming rappers, they always had, you know, they told these tough tales. They seem to be from a background that I thought, oh, yeah, that's acceptable. Someone like me can't, even though, like...
Because your upbringing was too happy.
Yeah, because I thought, you know, oh, well, hold on a minute. I grew up on a council estate. That should be enough. But then I thought, well, actually, I never had any concept as a kid of being, like, broke or unhappy. You know, my house was always one that was just full of creativity and fun and interesting people. And
I'm really sorry.
Yeah, you know, and constant encouragement from my parents. Oh, so I just thought, this is, you can't tell these stories in rap. No one wants to hear it. It took me a long time to realize it doesn't matter. As long as you can make interesting music and be an interesting character, it's fine. And I learned that the hard way, in a way, through battle rap.
So tell me, because I've never quite understood how it works. To me, it's like wrestling. I don't understand to what extent it's real or rigged, mm-hmm. or how mm-hmm. much do you know you're going to say before you get there, or how does it work?
Well, now it's completely different, okay? So it's two forms of battling I'm talking about here. Right now, it's more like boxing. So the bouts are set up with months in advance. You will study your opponent, everything you know about him. If you can, you know, get in contact with people that hate him or her, then even better, you find out little secrets, whatever you can find out to embarrass them. And then on the day, you'll do three rounds of maybe a minute each, just destroying the other person. So it's very organized. Right. Whereas when I did it, it was only one rule. You freestyle, you make it up. And I wouldn't say that one's necessarily better than the other. I'd say, if anything, the way it is now is more guaranteed entertainment because these guys have prepared. So it's like going to see a stand-up. And yeah, it's amazing that he's just doing the whole thing riffing. But actually, the quality is more likely to dip quite tragically as opposed to somebody who's written an incredible 20 minutes.
Yeah, well, that's a big, important difference, isn't it? And there's people who strongly disagree with the idea that you should go and just tell jokes. I'm talking about stand-up now. But at a certain point, I like it if you sort of think, okay, that was good, nice bit of crowd work. Mm-hmm. Can you give me some of the stuff you've slaved over?
There you go.
And honed.
Something memorable, something that just... I don't mind knowing that I've seen behind the curtain and that this is all an act. If it's a great act, it's a great act.
Yeah.
There's certain quotables that you remember from comedians that could have only ever been written, and that's a beautiful thing. And why shouldn't an audience the following night see that same beauty?
Yeah, and for the rap battles, you know, Abandon Man...
Yeah, of course.
Those Irish guys who go and they riff apparently off the top of their heads on subjects thrown at them by the audience and stuff. And it is mind-blowing.
It really is. I mean, with Rob, I mean, I'm Rob Broderick, who is basically a Bander Man. I met him very early on when I started doing stand-up because obviously people were saying, oh, you know, there's this other guy who raps, you know. So we came across each other. And actually, I went to a few of he used to run improv classes as well. And I went to check out his style. And I realized that what he does is he sort of really combines the two worlds because within stand-up, improvisational experts will always have a kind of structure, won't they? They'll have like a sort of... these kind of walls within which they feel they've got enough freedom to improvise. So it is improvisation, but at the same time, they're in control the whole time. So what Rob does is he creates these games that he can play that have got the same structure every night, but obviously something new is going to come out every night. Like for example, the What's in Your Pocket thing that he used to do. I mean, that blows comedy people's minds, audiences, I mean. Whereas in
rap... So explain that for someone who hasn't seen
it. Okay, so what I don't know if he does it anymore, but Rob used to get people to take objects out of their pockets and then he'd create a rap on the spot encapsulating all of those items somehow and saying a little something about the person that was holding it up, right? Which, like I say, in comedy terms, you're kind of looked at as like it's the return of the Son of God. Whereas if you were to do that in rap in 2016, it would be considered very hack.
Uh-huh.
But that's the same reason that I became a big hit in stand-up, you know, because I was doing shit that I wouldn't dare do in the rap world. It might be considered maybe corny, but in the stand-up world, it's something new, it's something fresh, and it was a different voice.
It's a valuable lesson to learn, isn't it? That sometimes the trick to making something work is just finding a new context for it.
There you go.
Or
and I stumbled across that with my act, I guess. Which wasn't really an act initially, it just became one.
So you started out sort of, quote, serious.
Very much so, man, very much so. Like, I'd sort of given up on trying to make a living from rap around 2006-ish. I'd put out my third CD, and it was doing okay, and I was a bit of a personality on the underground scene, but this was sort of before the real explosion of internet content for musicians, you know, and I was still struggling from an old school perspective to try and sell records. And I had a side job working for Mark Ronson. We'd been touring around on and off.
And how did you hook up with him?
It was from a night that I used to run in the West End out of my friend's record shop, which was called Deal Real, just in Carnaby Street. And we used to have a live night on Fridays, just get artists that we knew to come down and perform for free. It would just be a big blowout. We used to have a great laugh down there. And Mark was a sort of budding hip-hop DJ at the time, and he passed through. And we just got to know each other from that. And then he was learning the guitar, and he wanted to put this band together and do these covers. This is after he had like a sort of rap-ish album out called Here Comes the Fuzz.
Uh-huh. So what, 2005?
This is 2005, right. Yeah. And he put the band together, and it was just sort of a collective of different people. And he brought me on board as the rapper, and I used to like introduce the band as well and just be a general. I was just like a Bez, really. I was like a hip hop Bez.
Clown man.
Yeah, clown man. but, you know, it was great, and we had some amazing moments. But anyway, eventually I was removed from that outfit, and I just really couldn't face going back to. So like the underground rap thing, I was just getting a bit bored of it all. I had a young baby at the time, and I was really struggling for money and stuff, and I was really wondering what to do with my life, to be honest. And I was looking at normal jobs. I applied to become a spokesman for Kick It Out, like an anti-racism charity for football.
That presumably is not a big payday, though, is it?
I don't think so. I don't remember seeing anything amazing about the wages, but I thought, you know, you're a performer, you could talk about football and racism, these things are close to your heart, you could make a life like that.
Yeah.
You know? And I'd sort of just got to the idea, okay, now it's time to be a man. I've got a kid, sensible job, forget all this showbiz luck. And getting ready for the interview for that job, I got a call from a guy, I don't know if you know him actually, his name's Danny Robbins, writer. And I'd met him through, he used to have a show on Radio 1 back when I was doing music. And he was saying, you know, now he wrote comedy, and he'd written this sitcom for Lenny Henry for Radio 4, all black cast. Mm. And Danny, for those who don't know him, like a white guy. And he was feeling a little nervous about, you know, some of the dialogue and whatnot. And he called me up as his sort of requisite black friend and said, would you take a look at some of the, you know, the colloquialisms? You know, maybe you could help me out. I can get the BBC to pay you £200. So I met him in Nando's at Camden Town and went through the script. You know, saw a couple of things that I was like, yeah. I mean, I didn't know why I was there, but I just thought £200, why not?
Sure.
And, you know, there was a couple of little moments. I think there was one little moment where he'd put like Bomba Clot or like Blood Clot or something like that. I was like, when's this going out? And he said, it's like 6:30, Radio 4, Thursdays. I was like, okay, you can't say that. He's like, why not? I was like, well, it's just like, I mean, in Jamaica, it's like ridiculously rude.
Ah.
Like blood clot, for example, that's like calling someone a used sanitary towel. It's like really slow down.
Ah.
And he was like, oh, I thought it was just a, you know, an exclamation, like, ooh, you know, I've
chucked
my hand
in
the car door.
That's funny. I never knew it was really offensive. It's like one of those things like twat.
Yeah.
Me and Joe used to say
in America,
twat
you can't
on the
be
radio.
Going around saying twat.
No, and you can't say twat.
Yeah.
Especially up north in the UK, twat is really bad.
Twat's harder. Yeah. So, you know, it was little things like that. And then, you know, other things where I just thought, oh, I think it'd be funnier if he reacted like this or said that.
Yeah.
And then that was it, really. Got my £200. And then the next thing I know, the producer called me and he said, Lenny wants to meet you. He liked the changes you made, right? So I meet Lenny Henry and he's like, oh, you don't understand how important it is to have like a black writer. There's no black people behind the scenes, the BBC and media. And I'm stood there thinking, okay, I'm not a writer, first and foremost. Like, I'm nobody. And they decide to have me on for the whole series as a kind of like a script consultant.
Uh-huh.
So suddenly I was working in comedy, and it was at the end of that series that, you, I mean, you know how the game goes. It's like working in one job in this business becomes almost like a little mini audition for another job, depending on who you're working with. Because
yeah,
everybody
exactly.
moves on at the end, everybody moves on to their separate jobs. And if they like something that you did, they might give you a call. And that's exactly what happened. The producer got me writing gags all of a sudden for other Radio 4 shows. And this is the end of 2007 now. Mm-hmm. And it was during that process, I'd started writing little songs as well, silly little jingles and songs for some of the shows. So this producer says, I don't understand why you don't perform comedy. You know, you can write these funny songs, you can write gags, you should be performing comedy. And I was still in such rapper mode in those days. I was like, no, I'm not a joke, bruv. I'm a serious guy. You know, that's not my bag. And he said, look, come down to this night and just tell your story. I'm thinking, really? So I go down and I just went out there. It's so typical of my first year of doing comedy. I just went out there and it was so weird. There was no laughter.
Yeah.
But I didn't feel like I died because I didn't understand the concept of dying. I just went up there and talked. And I came off and so the producer said to me, you know what? I'll tell you what, it was really interesting. And if it was a talk, it would have been brilliant. But why don't you come back next month and like actually think of some gags. You can do that. You can write gags. I know you can. So that's what I did. I came back and I prepared a little thing about how incongruous it was for a rapper to work at Radio 4. And that got a few little chuckles. But again, I sort of ran out of stuff to say. So I called upon an old hack rap thing. You know, I said, you know, give me your names, give me like words or phrases or places that you come from and I'll do a rap about it.
Yeah.
So people shout out their names, places, little stories about themselves and I did a rap and it brought the house down all of a sudden. And I was like, oh, all right. And I walked off stage and two guys that worked at the pub said, oh, we do like a sort of late night comedy thing once a month here. You should come and do that rap thing. We'll give you 50 quid.
Mm.
So I was like, all right. And that was it. That's how it started. And it was so ramshackle my first year. Just never really fully preparing. And some gigs, I would, like I say, take the roof off and literally the next one, abject death.
But you didn't, it didn't freak you out?
No, because I didn't acknowledge it as death until, I don't know, months later, I'd entered a competition called So You Think You're Funny.
Yeah.
And I got all the way to the final, still using that same approach, not fully preparing anything. So in the build up to going up to Edinburgh to do the final of that competition in 2008, I was doing lots of little gigs wherever I could, underneath pubs, little backwaters, anywhere. And it was the heat of the summer, it was July, it was really, really hot. And I'd spent the last 3 months wearing a cardigan to all of my gigs,
mm-hmm.
for one reason. There's one night I was in quite a tough room and I was wearing a cardigan, not for any reason other than I was just wearing that cardigan. And I got up and I was always thinking to myself, I don't have a strong opener, you know. I got up there and again, I'm in. I thought, first, let me tell him I'm a rapper. Get that out of the way. I think that's important. I need to tell him that. And I got up there and I said, oh, hey, I'm Doc. I'm a rapper. And I could straight away, I could see people sort of wincing a little bit. So I went, not anymore. I wear cardigans now. But and literally just an aside like that, and it got a big laugh. And I thought, oh, maybe the funny thing is the fact that I'm a retired rapper.
Uh-huh.
And it sort of begun there. And it gave me so much confidence, the laugh on that cardigan aside, that I did the same thing the next night, wore a cardigan and said, not anymore, I wear cardigans now. And then that became my opener for like 3 months.
Yeah.
To the point where I was in this pub you know, trying to be spontaneous with this line that I've been saying for 3 months.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And it's boiling hot. We're in like a darkened room. People are like, you know, fanning themselves. And I go, hey, I'm Doc. I'm a rapper. Not anymore. And someone goes, mate, why are you wearing a cardigan? Why are you wearing a cardigan? It's boiling. And I thought, yeah, I've got to drop this bit. It's ridiculous.
Or just find another cooler item of clothing that you can wear in all seasons.
Yeah, that says old man.
That still says old guy.
Hey, there are moments in everybody's life. Some are big and some are small moments. I have done a selection of the big moments from my mind. Now I'm going to share them with you all. Moments, big moments.
I'm going to ask you now a question. Mm. This is a new feature on the podcast.
Oh, right, okay.
My biggest moments. And you can interpret that in any way you like.
Okay.
But I'm going to ask you for a few of your biggest moments throughout the podcast. We'll see how it goes. This might be a feature that only lasts for this episode. Oh. But so tell me about a moment, and I warned you about this morning.
Yeah.
Even though I should have warned you about it a few days
ago. No, it's fine. I don't think you want a few days on this kind of stuff, because right, then it starts getting a bit too...
You overthink it,
man, yeah. And it all feels a bit try hard.
I like that's my that's my MO. So,
big moments.
One of your biggest moments.
Mm. One of the really memorable ones that sort of ties into the story I was telling you about, the sort of transition from rap, was during the Ronson days. It was that, because we'd done some small gigs, but it was one where I walked out at a festival, and it was, you know, I don't know how many tens of thousands of people in the air. That's huge.
Is that the Isle of Wight one?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just massive, you know, and I've been in those crowds so many times. I love festivals. And, you know, sometimes you just turn back, jump up and turn back and just look at the mass of people and imagine what it must be like on stage.
Mm.
And that was a huge moment in my life, just stepping out. I was with Lily Allen and Amy Winehouse. We did a couple of songs.
You were part of a kind of...
It was like a collective. Yeah, it was Mark Ronson, me, Winehouse, Santo Gold.
Uh-huh.
You know, Santo Gold. The Haggis Horns, brilliant, like... Scottish horn section, obviously, and Daniel Merriweather, mm-hmm. Australian singer. So it's like a sort of real collective, and you know, we all did different numbers, which ended up being on the Virgin album, which we started recording about halfway through when we started touring together. But it's just that one moment, you know, stepping on. I remember Lily's mic wasn't working properly, and there was a few little technical difficulties, but still, like, everything you said, 40,000 people just like, rah! And the adrenaline that I felt lasted for a couple of days. I've never experienced that before.
Yeah.
And I think that's why everything else after that felt a bit of a come down, you know.
So what were you doing on that particular show then? Were you sort of rapping with
Lily? Yeah, it was a real range. Bit of backing singing, bit of rapping. I'd introduce the band. And then the other thing was a rap with Lily on a cover of the Kaiser Chiefs song, Oh My God.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I'd occasionally do a little rap for Amy on Valerie.
Oh, really?
Some of the first times it was performed.
Yeah.
Quite
and
mad
so would you guys
about.
All I know, very strange. Did you see that documentary about
of
Amy?
Of course.
Yeah, yeah.
Of course. I'm credited as a researcher in it.
Are you?
Yeah,
right?
I stayed behind a long time to see my name.
So you're
as
an
if
Oscar...
that was the most important thing in the film.
Sure. You're an Oscar winning researcher.
Dude, I never thought of it like that.
Yes, mate.
I'm putting that on the website, on my Twitter handle. Immediately, we might have to pause for me to do it.
That was a heartbreaking.
Oh, dude,
film.
It was a bit like watching a horror film.
Yes,
if I'm honest. I mean, I got contacted by the director a couple of years before the movie came out. I mean, the process of putting the footage together, doing the interviews, getting everything signed off, it takes forever. I mean, he's been working on it since Senna, you know. And he met with me. Initially, I was very, very skeptical about talking to him. I hadn't properly made the Senna connection, I don't think.
Right.
Because it was a friend of a friend, basically, who said, I know this guy, he's making this movie about Amy. And I was just like, not really interested. I mean, that band I was in, we lost two members, you know. And there's a lot of heartbreak and a lot of personal feelings and all
sorts
of stuff.
People because of drugs?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. We lost Jason Ray from the Haggis Horns, who was married to Corinne Bailey Ray, who was just, like Amy, just one of the loveliest people you'll ever meet. And it's just so heartbreaking when a young person, because I dealt with my dad's death around the same time, which was upsetting, of course. You know, it's your own dad. But at the same time, he'd had such a great innings. He was 81, you know, and he was ready as well. Just totally different. Going to a young person's funeral is like a next level of just horror, really. So, yeah, you know, it still felt a little bit raw. And also, I didn't want to say anything out of turn. I didn't know who else had turned it down or agreed. So I was a bit standoffish. And then when I made the Senna connection and realised how sensitive this guy was, you know, I agreed to sit down and talk with him. And I told him what I just told you. And he said, don't worry, everybody said the same thing. And he just made me some guarantees. And it was enough for me. I really felt he was a genuine soul, and I still do. Plus, he'd developed a close relationship with Nick, who was her original manager, who's just a top guy. And I thought, if Szymanski says it's okay, then it's okay. And sure enough, it was. I think the one thing you could take from that film, without any shadow of a doubt, is that the film is on her side. You know, like you watch that film, and for her dad to specifically get angry, or people at Ireland specifically get angry, I think sort of says more about them than anybody else, because I think what the film's doing is saying we're all a little bit at fault. We all made a joke about her, or we all did. None of us really acknowledged the seriousness of it.
Yeah. How do you think things could have been done differently there then? Because you feel one of the sad feelings you get watching it is that it's just, there's no way you can derail her almost. She's determined, it feels like, to. But, you know, and unfortunately, she's surrounded by all these people who seem unable or unwilling to derail her for whatever reason. But do you think anyone really could have helped someone like that?
I think it was tricky. I mean, you know from being an artist that no matter what level of artist you are, you have these huge insecurities and huge mood swings. If you add to that, like, the level of fame that, mm-hmm. that Amy had, the levels of pressure.
And then you pile drugs on top
of
that.
Yeah, we could have all been an Amy Winehouse, you know, and there's very little that people could really do when you consider her closest friends at a point were shut out, not necessarily directly by her. I think by the end it was even physically difficult to get close to her. So.
Yeah, yeah. That bit of footage where she wins the Grammy. Oh my God. And her, it's hard to describe the look on her face, isn't it? Because it's sort of shock and excitement and I don't know, but it's almost eerie because you sort of think it almost looks as if she knows she's doomed at that point.
Yeah, it's really, really odd that. Really, really odd. And it's something that you've seen before as well with certain people, that strange, I mean, there's that strange photo of Tupac staring out of the car window about an hour or so before he gets shot in Vegas. And there's a look on his face that it's just, he's had enough.
Yeah, yeah.
All the drama that's been following him around, you know. I actually did a thing for Radio 4, presented a documentary about a particular period in 1981 where a lot of crazy shit happened. And one of the people I interviewed was the last guy to interview John Lennon at the Dakota. And he had a similar moment with John the day before he was killed, you know, where he actually implored John to maybe up the security because he'd seen Mark Chapman hanging around, being weird. There'd been other threats. And John sort of laughed it off in a way that this interviewer felt a little bit like he's just, you know, he's tired of all the bullshit. He just wants to live his life, but he can't. It's a deal that you kind of make with the devil when you get as huge as that based off of your talent. And I can see similarities with Tupac, with Lennon, with Winehouse.
Yes.
And I don't think there's any coincidence that we rarely see their likes again, at least for long periods. So yeah, that was a big moment. Yeah. It turned somber at the end there. Sorry.
Well, that's okay. That's part of life. That's what makes this podcast so amazing. So we can accommodate the light and the dark.
This is an advert for Squarespace.
Hey guys, it's Broshak with me, Paul Broshak. We got Mike here. We're going to talk about his new MMA comedy special. We're going to talk about his view counts, and we're going to talk about conspiracy theories. What's up, Mike?
Hello, Paul.
Hey, brother.
I'm fine, thank you. I don't want to talk about any of those things anymore.
You don't?
No. I want to talk about... I built a website, Paul.
All right, stream some fights, settle some beefs, stick it to the elites, that kind of thing.
No, it's mainly dog pictures, Paul. And I did it on Squarespace. Have you heard of Squarespace? I went to squarespace.com/Buxton and I did a free trial and I tried some of the beautiful templates, Paul, and I typed things in. I dragged in pictures of the dogs. And before I knew it, I had a website, Paul. So I bought it and I've made some very sweet dog t-shirts and I sell those on the shop on the website.
Uh-huh. But do you still fight and stuff?
A little bit, but not really. Oh, and Paul, I wanted to tell you that when it comes time to buy your website or domain on Squarespace, if you use the offer code Buxton, you save 10%. Paul.
Thanks, Mike. Where'd you do that free trial?
Squarespace.com/Buxton.
And how sweet were the dogs?
Very.
You've written a children's book.
I have. There it is, look, you can see it.
I am bare.
We're actually sat in my man shed at the end of my garden.
This is nice.
All my stuff is here. There's some memorabilia knocking about.
And so this is your first children's book, right?
Yeah, yeah. I'm really hyped about it. Like, I'm really proud of it.
Because you've got children, right?
Yeah, and, you know, as you know from being a dad, you do a lot of accidental research into children's books.
You read a lot of bullshit.
Because you read a lot of shit.
Oh, mate.
There's so much. Don't get me wrong. There are some classics out there. We're all aware of what they are.
Let's not concentrate on the bad ones. I wanted to ask you about some of the books that you loved when you were growing
up. Oh, yeah.
And some of the ones that you have been... Because when you are a parent and you are reading to your children at night, when a good one comes along, it's... joyous.
You try and coax it into their hands every night.
Because sometimes they latch on to ones that are torture to read. And you just, have you ever hidden one or thrown one away?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, the ones that are sort of super promotional, that are just like spin-offs from movies, cartoons, just so lazily written or just covered in glitter.
Yeah.
Are just out. And they don't miss them, but you've got to sneak them away.
You do,
The worst invention for parents is the see-through recyclable bags, bin bags. The amount of times I've been caught out throwing some shit away that my kids do not want or need, but they see it, and then it's like, how could you?
Mate, you've got to wait till they're at school.
Yeah.
And then you do the charity shop run.
Have the clear out. No, there are some absolute... stone cold classics that I was so confident in from my childhood. I was so confident that I went to my mum's house and dug them out of the attic and brought them back and tested them on the kids.
So is it your mum that read to you when you were little?
My mum and my dad read to me quite a lot. My dad used to sing me a song. I always remember that. He used to sing Young at Heart. And when he got to This Is the Best Part...
The Frank Sinatra one.
Yeah.
The Bluebells one.
No, 100% the Sinatra. Dad, I'm really tired. Please.
And then he'd get his fiddle out.
quite. Yeah, no, I used to love that little Sinatra rendition.
Mm.
Yeah. But when I went back to my mum's, I dug out Not Now Bernard...
Oh, that's good.
Possibly my favourite picture book of all time.
That's good. And did it ever freak you out, Not Now Bernard?
It always made me laugh, which makes me worry a little bit about myself, because reading it back to my kids...
Do a precy for someone who's not familiar with Not Now Bernard.
Well, this is it. Reading it back to my kids, I realised Not Now Bernard by David McKee is actually a story about parental abuse. It's about neglect. A boy who's ignored thoroughly by his parents. He says... at the beginning to his mum, there's a monster in the garden. She says, Not Now Bernard. So he tells his dad, you know, she's doing the washing up, tells his dad, dad's trying to read the paper. Not Now Bernard. So he's ignored on page one and two. So page three, he goes to confront the monster on his own because his parents won't help. Monster just eats him. So he's dead. Page three, there's a homicide, right? Kid's dead. And then the monster goes in the house to the mum. And she's like, she breaks a vase. She's like, oh, Not Now Bernard. So he goes and bites the dad's leg. He's like, ah, Not Now Bernard. And they just carry on with their day. eventually the mum brings him like a TV dinner, plonks him in front of the TV. And throughout this day, you see how they would have treated their son with disdain, with no respect of his character, who he is.
Yeah.
You know, they treat the monster the same way. And in the end, the mum puts the monster to bed. And the monster actually says, for the first time, he says something. He says, "But I'm a monster." And she just says, "Not now, Bernard," and switches off the light, black. And it's like, it's so powerful. It's so funny, dark. It's everything. Like, that to me is the number one kids' book of all time, like picture books. I know that's controversial. People always say Where the Wild Things Are or
Tiger Who Hungry Came to Tea.
Yeah, they're all classics. Everyone, yeah. Don't get me wrong. Sure. But for me, Not Now, Bernard is the most sort of grown-up children's. I don't know.
It's very
funny to a 4-year-old.
Yeah.
And it's meaningful to a 36-year-old.
As a parent, I mean, it's shocking because it's one of the anxieties you have as a parent that, you know, you do just shut your children down sometimes. Because
how many times are you looking at your computer or your phone more than you're looking in your kids' eyes? They're trying to show you some shit they did, like a little drawing. Okay, the drawing's terrible, but, you know, they just want a little bit of your time.
Mm. And then with technology, it's so easy to palm them off on.
There you go. Take the iPad, shut up.
And they're happy to check it out.
Yeah.
And you think, all right, good, I've got some peace now. But then, it feels bad.
I'm terrified of the future. I mean, that's the main thing about being a parent, isn't it? I'm just terrified of the future. I don't sleep properly, even though now I can because my kids are big. I still don't sleep properly because I'm just always a little bit anxious.
Yeah. I think I have a certain amount of faith in the human race's capacity for adjusting and adapting.
Mm.
I feel like we've gone through very revolutionary times in the last 20 years.
I'm telling you, the digital revolution is possibly more profound than the industrial revolution.
Uh-huh.
I think in the way that it's changed the way we communicate with each other, the way we treat each other, our expectations of each other. I think it's deeper than the industrial. I genuinely do. Yeah. Industrial revolution made the way we live our everyday lives profoundly different, no question, and easier. And that's that for me is where the similarities end between the two. Look at dating, for example.
Mm-hmm.
You could do a full on like CSI level of investigation into a potential partner before even meeting them.
Yeah, down to the DNA,
everything. I mean, it's insane.
Yeah,
and I'm not saying that's a good or a bad thing. I'm just saying. It's nuts, and that's the nature.
Do you think
of
anyone really does that, though?
I don't know, but you've got the option.
Yeah. Would you get a DNA test? You know, like you can go and get tested and just see if you're likely to drop dead in 20 years.
I don't. That kind of stuff, I don't want to know.
I don't want to know.
I'd rather just drop dead.
I mean,
dead,
you
I
could
think.
Say, I suppose, from the people who are offering these tests, they would say, well, you have the opportunity to get treatment for certain conditions ahead of time, which might help you.
We're already living way too long,
yeah,
you know? I remember my dad saying, the last 10 years have just been shit. You know? They've just been really shit.
It's hard, yeah.
He was like, I don't want to live for another 20 years.
Yeah. I guess you need to be able to maneuver yourself into a situation where there are certain things you like that make you happy that you can carry on doing however old you are. You've just got to be mindful that your whole happiness is not based on snowboarding. because you're going to be unlikely to.
Because your knees are going to be the first thing to pack in.
No, 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 no.
Let's return to children's books a little for a little while. And what are the ones now that you have particularly enjoyed reading to your daughters?
There's some new guys out there that are absolutely superb. I mean, Emily Gravett, she writes children's picture books on a whole other level. She illustrates as well, but sort of kind of interactive without being naff. And then John Klassen, he's got a book called I Want My Hat Back, which has sort of done that weird thing that every now and again a children's picture book does, which is cross over and become like a book that adults just talk about because it's funny and it's kind of dark. And it's just about this sort of very deadpan looking bear on the search for his hat. It's got that sort of tradition of children's books, the journey, go around, ask a different animal.
Ah, yes.
The dialogue is it's sort of Woody Allen-esque. It's really funnily written. So it takes those traditions, turns them on their head. And there is a murder towards the end. So there's like a big twist, and I wouldn't want to ruin it, but it's a fantastic book. There's loads of great books on the market, and just to see mine anywhere close to them.
So what's your? Like, what, I don't know your. I haven't read your book yet.
Well, make sure you take a copy.
I'd love to take a copy.
It's
and
just about a bear who's a prick, really.
Yeah.
I got quite frustrated by those children's books that like suddenly become moralistic without really earning it.
Mm-hmm.
So I just wanted to create a character who sort of. Does he get away with stuff? Maybe he does. Maybe he does. You decide if what he's doing is right or wrong. But it's a slow process. It takes like nearly 2 years to get a picture book out.
Whoa.
It's really slow. Like my kids don't even care anymore. You know, they're too old.
Yeah.
When I wrote it, I was like, oh, it's going to be great having little kids. And they're going to love like having a little picture book. No, they've both moved on.
They've moved on. They're reading Charlotte Bronte. I'm looking forward to introducing that to my daughter. We're reading the Northern Lights trilogy at the moment.
Great.
That's really good.
What happened with the movie? Just kind of.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you that.
Did it flop?
It massively flopped.
It was a flop, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And it's a shame because obviously they expected it to be this huge franchise which would roll on.
Is it one of those unfilmable things? Is that what it is?
I mean, it's partly. Yeah, it would be very hard to do a really great job and to compress all that stuff and all those characters. And the temptation to lean on crappy CG would be very strong.
Yeah.
Because the whole, one of the conceits of the whole universe is that everyone has an expression of their soul in physical form.
Right.
A demon. Okay. They call them demons. D-A-E-M-O-N.
And you've got your hands out there like as if you're holding like a glass ball.
That would be your demon. It would be like a little bunny or whatever.
Oh, right.
So some people have
and it's like on your shoulder kind of thing.
It follows you around and it can talk. And you chat to it and it's your pal. For your whole life, and it's cool. The opposite sex to what you were born. So right. If you were born female, then you have a little male demon. He doesn't deal with like funny. Transgender demons, but maybe that's in a right. separate okay. book. But you know, there was lots of good things about that Golden Compass film, and they certainly tried, but it just didn't work out for whatever reason, and they abandoned the whole thing. At some point, someone will try it again, and you'll get some NRE2. Type director who might have a new spin
It feels like that's what it needs. Like, I don't you ever think, like, the films that are remade are always the ones that just don't need a remake? And then I can always think of films that I think, somebody needs to do this again.
Yeah.
You know? Like, they're busy remaking, you know, The Italian Job or Get Carter or something like that.
Yes.
And I think of films like Dark Days. Was it called Dark Days? The one with Angela Bassett? The one about dreams?
Not
Strange Days.
Strange Days.
Do you remember Strange Days?
Yeah, Catherine Bigelow.
Catherine Bigelow. That film there has got a brilliant premise, right? Absolutely brilliant. There's this guy that deals in dreams. And they're
memories
on these little... It's so of its time that they're on like... what was that crap
mini
technology?
Discs.
Mini discs. They're on mini discs.
Yeah.
You know? And I just thought if someone like, you know, your man Nolan, Chris Nolan had
yes.
this, somebody could make a really great film out of this now.
I know, and instead they just go ahead and make films that they nailed the first
time
around.
Yeah, they're absolutely nailed. It never makes sense to me. I always think about, you know, you and Joe and how much you used to take the piss out of movies and these situations and stuff, and it always reminds me of something that Joe said. Because there's a story behind this story. It's the story of how I met you and the story of how I met Joe separately.
Uh-huh.
I was working on Attack the Block. I wrote some songs for Joe.
That's right.
for the film. So I got invited to the premiere, which was like, to me, so excited. I'd never been to a premiere before, in fact, or since actually. But, you know, me and my wife were there. We were hyped, you know, ready to stay to the very end to see my credit and the whole thing. But, you know, Joe did the requisite thing of coming on stage with the cast, you know, and just a quick announcement beforehand. And he said something that's always stayed with me. He said, you know, me and Adam, we used to take the piss out of films all the time. And he said, now I'm going to have to rethink that because I've realized how hard it is to make a shit film, let alone a good film. You know, just the process of putting a shit movie together takes hundreds of people hours. And that's always kind of stuck with me. I kind of respected the filmmaking process a lot more since then. And what amazes me about Attack the Block is you... In amongst all that bluster, the action and the comedy, the horror, you can still feel the essence of that very personal story for Joe being mugged in the place where he grew up unexpectedly and wanting to know the story behind that rather than just the shock of being mugged. That little personal anecdote, you can still feel that all the way through the movie. And I think it's really, really hard to get across your original message from your original screenplay, no matter what it is, in a big movie situation. Because after a while, it's just everything gets more and more bastardized because of time or money or other chefs, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And I always admire Joe for that, I think.
I boycotted the film because I found it very racist. So I would never see it. I'm joking, of course. Speaking of racism, though, one of the things that I saw of yours early on was on Russell Howard's Good News.
Right, yeah.
And you did a bit called Everybody's Racist.
Yeah.
A rap.
It's a mantra, repeatedly say this. You're not a loser, it's just everybody's racist. Yeah, that's right, I said it. Why do you think nobody ever give you any credit? Why you last on the list of your doctor's patients? Chronological, or is your surgery racist? What type of dog shits on the pavement in front of your house? Alsatian, racist. Say you're typing in a search engine, trying to write haters with a Z at the end, and your computer goes, did you mean haters? That's how you know Google's racist. How come every time an igloo's made, it's always white? Eskimos, racist.
Can you talk me through how that routine came about?
Huh.
If you remember.
So one thing that always made me chuckle was being around some of my friends who would, you know, just smoke weed, just play video games, but always be really vocal when it came to why they weren't working, you know, why they didn't have a job or why they weren't getting ahead in life. And it was because of racism or like some kind of government-based conspiracy. And it always made me laugh because I'd be looking at them sat there smoking a huge zoot, playing FIFA. You know, thinking, maybe it's a bit of both. Who knows? Maybe it's a bit of you, a bit of them. I'm just going to throw it out there. You know, we debate about it and laugh about it. And I just thought it was a real issue that I could make a really preachy, serious rap song about. Or I could make a serious point in a really stupid way, which I much, much prefer doing. So some people get that and some people don't, and it's fine, you know. But what it's really about is exactly that, you know. So I'm kind of rapping from the perspective of a collective of people that I know who will blame everything on somebody else rather than themselves.
But had you experienced racism up to that point?
Oh yeah, of course.
Make you feel differently about writing that, and were you worried about writing something jokey about a serious subject like
not,
that?
Not at all. I was never panicked because I always thought if I'm ever challenged, I've got so much to say about this from so many different sides. You know, if anybody found it offensive for one reason or another, I can totally back it up. That's never ever been thrown at me for that, to be honest, which I'm glad about. And I think sometimes you know when something's non-offensive by how much everybody, a diverse group of people, enjoy it, you know. Other times you know how offensive something is from within because you don't do the bit because you see someone in the crowd who you think might be offended by it. Mm-hmm. That's how you know it probably is offensive. You got a whole joke about disabled people and suddenly there's five people in wheelchairs in the front row and you don't do the bit. It might not be a great bit. Because if it was a great bit, you could say it and the guys in the wheelchairs will probably enjoy it more than anybody in the room, you know? And there's prejudice in that, even in that, isn't there? To withdraw your disabled bit because there's disabled people in. They would be the first to say, well, dude, what? We can't take a joke. Well, that's prejudice in itself to say that you're not going to do the bit because we're here, you know?
What was the last thing that you were offended by? Do you remember? Oh. Do you get offended? Do you feel like, I'm offended?
Yeah, it's a weird one, isn't it? Because, you know, if you class yourself as a comedian or somebody who, you know, takes the piss as part of their profession,
yeah,
it does feel a bit rich to get offended by stuff.
Yeah, because I think generally you don't think that's offensive.
Mm.
I just think it's weird when people start characterising something as offensive. It's like things are usually just lame.
You know, people often ask me, oh, are you offended by the fact that this white comedian is using the N-word? I go, well, I don't know. Let me see the context. I don't want to see what you've written down or, you know, taken a clip from on YouTube. Bring me to his show or her show. Let me see the whole show. Let me see it in context, full context with the rest of the act. And I will tell you if I think it's lazy or totally fine, you know? And I think you've got to have that context.
And do you get, because you've worked with Ricky Gervais quite a bit.
Yeah, who, you know, splits.
And he's right. He's someone who treads the line in a lot of ways.
He checks stuff with me, you know. Sometimes.
I mean, he did that joke that about Lenny Henry in Extras, which was
tough.
Really, I mean, I didn't like that joke.
I've worked with both men, yeah. You know, and...
And for those who didn't see it, was that there was a moment where he was talking to some people and they were talking about black comedians. He was like, come on, name a funny black comedian.
And he says, like,
he looks
Chris
at
Rock.
A picture of Lenny Henry on the wall. Yeah, and he's like, who's
Chris
a funny...
Rock, Eddie Murphy, and he says, British.
Right, right.
And it stumps him. And they look. He looks around the room and there's a poster of Lenny Henry and he still can't think of anybody. That's the gag.
Yeah.
It was funny, but it's just... Because it's so close to the bone. It's somebody from our... I look at all comedians and I think no matter if I don't find you funny at all, I see you as part of my sort of community in a way. Yeah. Like I've sometimes seen stand-ups sort of have a go at, you know, a bigger stand-up as part of their routine. And I just think, no. You don't do that. Maybe we'll have a laugh about that comic, you know, in the pub or whatever, but I don't think you can work it into your set. So I don't know. I think pick your targets, basically. And maybe that one was a little below the belt. But then at the same time, I have to say I laughed. So, yeah, I can't really say shit. I can't really get on my high horse about it. But no, working with Ricky is interesting because that is what he does. He polarizes opinion on a professional level. Like, as many people love him as loathe him. Which is interesting. Whereas the rest of us are probably more likely to just try and make everybody love us, please.
Finally, before we wrap things up, how about hitting me with another my biggest moment? Here's the my biggest moment jingle.
Hey, there are moments in everybody's life. Some are big and some are small. Moments, big moments.
I thought about this and I thought this has to be in there because it's kind of life and death. My younger brother saved my life in Accra, of all places.
Where's that?
In Ghana. It's the capital of Ghana.
Wow.
I was out there for a family event that had all gone hideously wrong. And so much so that I decided to leave Ghana and come back to England early to pay for a whole new plane ticket. That's how drastically bad this event had gone. I can't really get into detail of why it went so badly, but
just family drama.
Oh, and I decided to have this red snapper that I'd seen where I was staying that looked delicious before I got on this early plane. So I sat down with my uncle, my brother-in-law and my little brother, and it was absolutely delicious, this grilled red snapper. Took a big bite of it and a huge bone got lodged in my throat.
Mm.
And I just couldn't cough it up. I couldn't swallow it. I knew I was struggling, you know, almost immediately. I was panicky. I couldn't speak. I was tapping my uncle. He tried to do the Heimlich on me. He didn't know what he's doing. He's trying to do the Heimlich on me and not working. Staff were sort of like coming out. People are starting to freak out a little bit.
How old were you?
This was about, I think this was 2008. So I just started doing comedy.
Yeah.
Yeah, not that long ago. And, you know, I'm out of my chair now. I'm on my hands and knees. My brother-in-law starts thumping my back, just like whacking me. And I could see my hands. They were turning the gray.
Oh, man.
Yeah. And then my vision started blurring.
Oh.
And everything started turning white. And I was like, Oh my God.
I'm going to die.
Like, I'm actually going to die.
Because I wanted that red snapper.
Because of, like, a fish in Ghana. And I'm not even having a good time. Not, like, dying having a good time.
Yeah.
Like, this is it. I can't believe this is where it ends, you know?
Wow.
I actually had those thoughts. I never thought that would happen.
Was it terrifying?
Oh my God, it was terrifying. I didn't have any of that your life flashes before your eyes thing. I just thought, oh, I'm not going to see my kids, my wife again. The other thing that I became acutely aware of was my brother-in-law punching me in the back. Because I was thinking, I'm dying here. But that's still really annoying. That's really annoying and it's not helping.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, my brother hauled me up, my younger brother, and he just shoved his fingers down my throat and I vomited.
Uh-huh.
And the propulsion pushed the bone up and out of my throat. And I was fine.
Oh, man.
But yeah, he essentially saved my life. So I guess I owe him a lot. I have to do anything, I think. Is that how it goes? I don't know. Yeah.
That's grim.
My third moment is much quicker. I can sneak it in at the
Go
end
on,
if you want.
Sneak one in.
It was actually going to see The Force Awakens. And it's not so much because like I'm a huge Star Wars geek, but there was just this moment, sat there. I had my wife, my two kids there, and there was a moment about 10 minutes in. I think it was when that you get that first sense of that fallen Imperial starship.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's the... what's her name, the main
Rey?
Character?
Is it Rey?
Something like
Rey,
that.
Rey, flying around, looking for scraps.
Scavenging.
And I just looked across. You know, we all looked across at each other a couple of times during that scene, just like, oh, this is going to be good. And it was just a moment where I felt complete and total happiness.
Yeah.
For a real sort of fleeting moment, I just felt this is everything, you know? Star Wars, my family were all just over the moon. The reason it struck me so hard is because I never give happiness a chance. I always, like, instead of just enjoying the moment, I think about the next moment, or I overanalyze the moment instead of just enjoying and being in it. You know, and then there's constant search for happiness. I'm constantly thinking, oh, maybe the grass is greener. Maybe I shouldn't be a family man. Maybe I should just like walk out and change my name and go and live in Mexico and see what happens, you know, or just all this stupid stuff. I can never just look at my situation and think, dude, this is amazing.
Yeah,
like this is incredible in comparison with a lot of other lives you could have lived. This is amazing. Like, just enjoy it. And that moment, I really felt that, you know.
It took J.J. Abrams.
J.J. Abrams.
To give you a philosophical epiphany.
God, that film was good.
There we go. Ben Bailey Smith. Thank you very much indeed to Ben for talking to me. I really enjoyed that. And speaking of Star Wars, I went out and invested in the Blu-ray of The Force Awakens the other day at Sainsbury's. And I got the light side edition. You get a choice of a cardboard cover that is mainly black or cardboard cover that is mainly white. And I went for the white one because I thought I'm going to stay away from the dark side. Because, I just, you know... I'm just old. I'm getting old. At a certain point, you know, like when you're young, the dark side's great, isn't it? Once you're approaching 50, you think, no, I tell you what, let's keep the dark side at bay for as long as possible. Anyway, it was fun. It was actually, I enjoyed myself more than I did at the cinema, seeing it for the first time. I watched it with my daughter, Hope, and with my wife. My wife, she had not seen The Force Awakens and found it greatly entertaining. And then after that, I forced my wife to watch Special Correspondence, Ricky Gervais's film, on Netflix. And now my wife has left me. I'm joking. I haven't seen it yet. I'm sure it's terrific. Thanks very much indeed to Seamus Murphy Mitchell for production support and to Matt Lamont for editing help. Thank you for downloading this podcast. Until the next time we're together, I want you to take extra good care out there. All right? I love you. Bye!